All right, welcome in everyone to the Deep Dive. We're diving into a fascinating case today. Nassau Sports v. Peters back in 1972. It's a case that really sits right at this crossroads of sports contracts and antitrust law. And, you know, I think for anyone listening, especially, you know, thinking about your future legal careers, it raises this question. Have you ever wondered why teens seem to have so much control over a player's career, even after their contract is technically over? Well, today's case offers some pretty important answers about that.
It does. And, you know, it really shaped how we think about, you know, player movement and team control in pro sports, even today. You know, you can't really talk about Nassau Sports v. Peters without understanding the context of the 70s, early 70s in professional hockey. We have the World Hockey Association, the WHA, coming on the scene and really sort of challenging the established power of the National Hockey League, the NHL. And this new league, well, it created an environment where players had more leverage. They could demand higher salaries.
Right. The WHA is waving around these big contracts like, hey, come play for us. And right in the middle of all this, at the center of this case, is this thing called the reserve clause.
Yeah, the reserve clause. Mm-hmm. It was a standard part of NHL contracts back then. Essentially, it gave teams this right, a right to unilaterally renew a player's contract for another year, you know, after the initial term was up.
So even if a player's contract ran out, the team could just say, nope, you're staying with us for another year.
Exactly. And the idea behind it, you know, the stated purpose at least, was to try and keep rosters stable. It was to protect the investments that these teams were making in their players.
Right, to make sure those players didn't just jump ship to another team. But of course, the flip side is it severely limited a player's options, right? They couldn't just go out and test the free market.
That's right. Have the WHA showing up, offering more money. Well, it really threw a wrench into this whole system.
Okay, so enter Gary Peters. He's the player at the center of our story.
Right, so Gary Peters, he has a contract with the Boston Bruins in the NHL. And of course, standard at the time, it has this reserve clause. Then, you know, things get a little complicated. The Bruins end up transferring Peters' rights to a new team, the expansion New York Islanders, or as they're referred to in the legal proceedings, Nassau Sports.
Okay, so we have a brand new Islanders franchise. They're excited. They want Peters to be a part of their team. But
Peters sees this opportunity with the WHA, right? He ends up signing this much better deal, more lucrative deal, with the New York Raiders.
So naturally, Nassau Sports, the Islanders, they're not too happy about this.
Not at all. They've invested in acquiring Peters, and now he's going to go play for a rival league. Mm. So they go to court, right? They file for an injunction to stop Peters from playing for the Raiders.
And their argument is that he's breaking his contract, right? Because of that reserve clause.
Exactly.
So now we're in court, and there are two big legal questions here. First, is that reserve clause even enforceable? And second, even if it is, does enforcing it basically create an illegal monopoly violating antitrust laws?
Big questions. And on the first one, the enforceability, the court actually sided with Nassau Sports. They said, look, reserve clauses are common. They're standard in sports contracts. And Peters, he signed the contract knowing it was there.
Right. But it wasn't just as simple as he signed it, end of story.
Right.
I mean, there was more to it. Peters' skill level, his talent, played a pretty significant role in the court's decision.
Yeah, that's right. The court really focused on what they called Peters' exceptional talent as a big part of the reason why they felt they could grant the injunction. In fact, Justice Nahar in the ruling actually said, the primary requisite for enforcing the option clause is that the player be an athlete of exceptional talent. So the court is saying, look, a player with this much talent, this unique ability, he's not easily replaced. So enforcing the contract, making him stick to it, is more justified in this situation.
Makes sense. So it's not just any player. It's because he's Gary Peters. And also, the contract had a salary arbitration clause, right? How did that factor in?
Yeah, that was important too. The court saw that arbitration clause as a way to make the whole agreement fairer. It gave Peters a chance to dispute his salary if the Islanders decided to exercise that option in the reserve clause.
So it wasn't just the team dictating terms. There was at least a process for negotiating. Okay, so the contract seemed enforceable to the court. But what about that antitrust argument? I mean, the Raiders, Peters, they were saying the whole reserve system in the NHL was illegal, that it was restricting trade.
Absolutely. That was their big argument. They said it kept players from really marketing their skills, that it created an unfair playing field. But the court, they did something interesting here. They separated the issue of Peters' individual contract with Nassau Sports from the bigger question of whether the NHL's entire reserve system was a problem.
Right. So they're saying, we're not going to rule on the whole system today. We're just looking at this one contract. I remember learning about this. It's the idea of separability, right?
Exactly. The court used the separability doctrine to say, look, we can decide if this contract is enforceable without having to analyze the entire NHL reserve system right now. They basically said, even if the system itself might have antitrust issues, that doesn't automatically mean this specific contract is invalid.
So they basically kicked the can down the road on the antitrust issue.
Exactly. They said these bigger antitrust questions, those are for another day, another court case.
Yep.
This case was about Peter's contract and the request for the injunction.
Okay. So for Nassau Sports to get that injunction, they also had to show they'd suffer what's called irreparable harm if Peters went off and played for the Raiders. What was their argument there?
Their argument was all about money. They said, look, we spent about $300,000 to get the rights to Gary Peters. Remember, this is 1972, so that was a serious amount of money back then.
Huge investment.
Exactly. So they argued that losing a star player like Peters after putting up that kind of money would really hurt the Islanders. It would damage their ability to compete, maybe even threaten the whole franchise. And the court agreed. They said, yeah, that's a legitimate argument. That qualifies as irreparable harm.
Right. So the court's thinking, we can't just let Peters walk away after all this. But then there's this other thing they have to consider, the balance of hardships. They have to weigh the harm to the Islanders against the potential harm to Peters if he can't play for the Raiders, right?
Exactly. They have to look at both sides. And the court acknowledged, yeah, Peters is probably going to lose money if we block him from playing in WHA. But they ultimately said the balance tipped in favor of Nassau Sports. I mean, after all, Peters had signed the contract. He knew about the reserve clause.
He agreed to it.
And he had the arbitration option to try and negotiate his salary. So the court's like, you can't just walk away from a deal because a better offer comes along. They also considered the potential harm to the Raiders, but they didn't see that as strong enough to outweigh Nassau's contractual rights and that big financial investment they'd made.
So bottom line, Nassau Sports wins. Peters can't play for the Raiders that season. But what does this all mean in the bigger picture? What's the lasting impact of Nassau Sportsy Peters? How did it affect the whole legal landscape of pro sports?
Well, Nassau Sports v. Peters definitely made reserve clauses look a lot more enforceable, at least when you're talking about players with exceptional talent and when the contracts had some kind of way to work out salary disputes. It set a precedent for courts to step in, issue these injunctions, and stop players from breaking those clauses. But, as we talked about with the separability doctrine, it didn't totally settle the tension between contract law and antitrust issues. By focusing on just this one contract, they kind of left the door open for future challenges to the whole reserve system.
And those challenges did happen, right? I mean, this case kind of set the stage for later cases like Mackey v. NFL, which really shook things up in terms of player free agency.
Exactly. Mackey v. NFL really changed the game. But Nassau Sports v. Peters was important. It showed that courts were willing to uphold these reserve clauses under the right circumstances. But it also left room for broader arguments about antitrust law and player rights to be made later on.
Okay, so for everyone listening out there, especially those of you in law school, what are the key things to take away from Nassau Sports v. Peters? What should we be thinking about?
I think one of the most important takeaways is that courts generally want to enforce contracts, especially when we're talking about people with unique skills and talents. And this case also highlights how, even in a specific industry like pro sports, you have this interplay between contract law and antitrust law. Sometimes they clash. A contract might be fine on its own, but the whole system is operating within, that might be a problem.
Right. It wasn't just a blanket endorsement of reserve clauses. It was about the specific facts of this case. Peter's exceptional talent, the arbitration clause. It really shows how complex the legal side of professional sports can be.
Yeah.
How individual contracts bump up against these bigger questions of competition and player movement.
It's a great example of how legal precedent gets made.
Right.
You know, one very specific decision based on a unique set of facts, and then that ripples out and contributes to bigger shifts in the law and how businesses operate over time.
Absolutely. Well, this has been a really fascinating look at Nassau Sports v. Peters, a real turning point in sports law. Thanks for diving deep with me. And for those listening, here's a question for you to ponder. Given everything that's changed since 1972 with free agency, player rights, all of that, how do you think a similar case would play out today? What factors would a court focus on now? It's something to think about. And if you're interested in more cases like this, be sure to check out the LexaPlug podcast for in-depth, accessible discussions on complex legal issues, stuff that's relevant to all of you as you move forward in your legal careers.
Great question. It really underscores how law is constantly changing and how it applies to different industries, always evolving.
All right. Thanks again for listening to The Deep Dive. Until next time.
See you next time.